This is Dorothy Harrison interviewing Penny Edlin on her experiences in the Second World War. So let's begin, Penny, with your biographical information, your name, when you entered service, and something of your background, where you were born and your education and so on.
I was born in Hibbing, Minnesota in 1922. My name is listed as Sarah Penrose Schimmel. However, most of my life I've gone by Penny.
Let me interrupt here and ask you to spell your last name.
Capital S-C-H-E-M-M-E-L.
Good. I wanted that because this will not necessarily appear on the written portion of this, and so the typist who's going to do this will like to know how to spell that correctly. Go ahead.
My father was a mining superintendent, and so we were moved around the northern part of Minnesota throughout all of the iron mining sections. However, you might say I grew up within a 250-mile radius of Hibbing, Minnesota. And I attended the junior college at Hibbing and then went on to the University of Minnesota, where I graduated in 1943 in physical therapy. Shortly thereafter, I graduated in June, and then in August, I was sworn into the Army, directly in, and was assigned to Nichols General Hospital here in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, that's the way you got to Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they told us that unless you volunteered, you would not be going overseas. So I figured that my stay at Nichols was going to be a long one. Of course, I was green. I didn't know any better at the time. In late fall, they said, they weren't getting enough volunteers for overseas duty, so you would be assigned. By the way, I also went in with a second lieutenant commission. So in latter part of December, I received orders to go and to Spokane, Washington, and join the 82nd General Hospital, which was going overseas. We did not, at that time, know where, but so anyway, I took a short leave, came home to say my fond farewells, and then about mid-January went out and joined the unit, which was training beside Baxter General Hospital in Spokane. However, when I got out there, I found that I was going to be one of about 10 girls to join the unit there. The rest would be picked up at the port of embarkation. And the girls were the five Red Cross workers, two PTs, two dietitians, and one nurse who was affiliated with Baxter at the time. Well, Baxter did not know really what to do with us. I mean, they didn't have enough work for us to be spending a whole lot of time there, and the fact that we didn't know from day to day whether we were going. So they kind of didn't give us anything to do. So the men of our unit decided, well, they were going to put us in training with them. So we had to learn how to drive every vehicle on the post. And the boys had a big time. They'd take us out and they'd say, okay, there's a body over there. Now take this ambulance and go over into that field. And I was at that time of about 105 pounds and was going across this field and bouncing up and down. then they took us, we had to go through the booby trap school with them and the gas chamber with them and the hikes, except we didn't have shoes to fit us, so they put men's boots on us that
the smallest size.
But anyway, we finally received orders then to go across country to Boston.
Now you were still at this still point with the 82nd.
And this, I stayed with the 82nd through my whole career. And so they split our unit. One took a northern route and one took a southern route to, I guess, confuse the enemy where we were going. And we headed up. I was on the northern group.
And you were going by train?
By train.
You had gone out by train.
Yes, but this was a troop train. And but we had a lot of fun going across country. The officers were in one section and kind of toward the end. So at night, one night we had a weenie roast in the caboose.
Well, nothing like
And another funny thing that happened, we had to stop every day. It took us about 10 days to go across country because we were going up and down and around. And this was up in northern Minnesota again, mind you, around my own home area. And we had to stop and once a day and have 15 minutes of exercise or running or something to
keep you active.
Uh-huh. And the colonel has said as long as there were only the 10 of us, we did not have to stay in uniform if we didn't want to. We could just wear our civvies. So, of course, we were wearing slacks when you got out in that cold weather. And we stopped at this one station and we got out, and an old man, I'd say about, who probably had been in World War I, looked at us and said, troop followers.
So, he must have thought that the army was very accommodating as soon as you got the places on the train.
But anyway, we finally got out to Camp Miles Standish. And at that time, we were there, of course, with many, many units because we went in the largest convoy ever to leave the port, or the largest one up to that time.
And which port?
Yeah, it was out of Boston.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But we were at Camp Miles Standish where they processed us, changed us from our blues to the olive drab uniforms and all of that. And made sure we had all of our immunizations and whatnot, and then left out of Boston about, I don't know the date, it was the last part of February.
In 1944. Now pause just a moment here, Penny, let me ask a question. You said you got out of your blues and into olive drab. Well, of course, I understand olive drab.
Mm-hmm.
But did they have these uniforms on hand to fit you with, or did you already have the olive drabs?
No, we were sent over to a big distribution center, and you told them what size you were right. in your blues. You turned in your blues, and issued you your olive drabs.
Now, you said you were in blues. I'm not familiar with the word blues. Was this a blue uniform meant for nurses?
This was the uniform before the olive drab came out, and this was back in 43. This was what I was in when we went into the Army.
Was it a light blue or
no? It was a dark blue. And mm-hmm. The capes. We had the big
capes.
That were lined in kind of a maroon. And the piping was in maroon.
Maroon.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a little cap. With a bill on the front.
It was exactly the same as the olive drabs. We had a one with the bill, and then, I've forgotten what the name of the one that that just sat on your
side,
head.
Sat on your head uh-huh. on the side.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And at that time, we were in white uniforms when we worked in the clinics, when you had your blues. When we went overseas, we went into seersucker wraparound uniforms with the seersucker hats.
And also, didn't you have slacks finally overseas, seems to me that someone said, well, at least it may have been in evac hospitals or...
We were not issued slacks.
You were not.
No,
you wore the seersuckers all the time.
We wore the seersuckers for duty and then the, you know, your olive drab skirts and whatnot. We wondered why they were setting up these tents within, oh, I guess about a half mile radius, because we could see them going up. And it was all around the hospital. Then the colonel stood up at lunch and said, we are going back. I want everybody to go back to the wards immediately, and we will have a quick inspection. All patients are to go to the back of the wards, and we will search their beds and pillows and all of their belongings. Well, they found glass, knives, forks, everything imaginable that had been sharpened and whatnot. It turned out that a report had been received that all prisoners in England were going to try a massive escape on Christmas Eve, because they felt that the Americans would be celebrating, and this would be a revolt within the island itself.
And strange that they would have, with an island, how could they have expected to get off? Obviously, they just meant to create
complete havoc.
Havoc.
Uh-huh. And but this was why they were had completely surrounded our unit with MPs and another group of, there had been stationed some paratroopers in the area preparing to go over and make their jumps and whatnot. So they just put those, completely surrounded us to give us protection. Also, on Christmas Eve morning, about 5 o'clock, you could hear bombs dropping. They dropped close enough so that it broke some of our windows, but it wasn't, you know, really that they were going to hurt us. But some of the planes had gotten through and had dropped enough.
Was this, did they feel this was a support move for the hospital patients who were going to riot? Was this the idea?
No, this was the Germans that had broken through and gotten some of the, they were giving the air support, they were giving the air support for the people that were supposed to be escaping.
Oh, wait a minute, I must be sure. They're in England.
Mm-hmm.
We're still at Whitchurch.
They're still at Whitchurch, and these were German bombs that were dropped close enough. And it was the only time
anything come near you.
And we were awakened. We heard this noise, but we were awakened really by the chief nurse coming through and saying, "All people reporting for 6 o'clock, run from hut to hut."
Because of shrapnel.
Because they were just in case, you know, they were worried that they might get closer than what they were, and to make sure that all of the blackout shades, boards were up. Things like that. But so anyway, that was one thing where it had filtered through.
Interesting that they should have had that good spy organization that messages could have gotten to the continent.
And it was very odd, because every patient you treated, you'd think,
Is
this one of ours? Mm-hmm. And we gave them excellent treatment, there was no doubt about it. But getting back also to the fact that they would not claim that they could speak English, we had a whole clinic full, and I would say there would have been at that time about 15 in the clinic at one time. And I was massaging this one boy, and none of them claimed to be able to speak English. And I was massaging this one boy, and he was just a baby, really. And I said, Abbott, that was the name of one of our Corporal Abbott, I said, how old do you have to be before you get whiskers? And he said, I guess 14 or so. At least. And I said, this kid doesn't even have peach fuzz. And with that, they all snickered. So we knew that they could understand. So that's how we found out that there was a whole lot more
of them could speak English. Well, when we were in Germany, we found that the young people, this was before the Second World War, 1936, when I traveled there, that the young people were almost all educated in English. Mm-hmm. You could only, if you couldn't find an older person, you asked a young person, and they could speak English. Mm-hmm. How did you manage with the German patients? Did you have an interpreter who went around with you, or did you use the German officers?
Well, if it became absolutely necessary, we used the German officers. The nurses on the floor, there were a few German doctors there too. And they would call in, the doctors would call in the doctors. However, we had several doctors that could speak German. Mm-hmm. So we tried to, you know, accommodate our everything. But in about, it was in March, most of the patients were then able, we had rehabilitated them or they were well enough that they could all be transferred over into a prisoner camp.
Camp, the hospital.
Uh-huh. So then we reverted back to our American patients.
And this was at what time? How long did you have?
In March. From November
through
March.
To March.
Uh-huh, which about 5 months, I'd say.
And this was a hospital that came from the Cherbourg Peninsula,
underground hospital at Brest.
Oh, at Brest.
Brest.
Excuse me, my mind was wandering when you were talking about that.
And one of the interesting things was one of the first patients, or within the first few weeks of American patients, my husband, who wasn't my husband at the time, but I was dating him, brother came in as a
patient.
And he came into one of the hospitals in our hospital center, which was usually, there were, I don't know how many, but three or four hospitals within an area, and then they had a headquarters center. And he was in one of the others, so we just moved him over into ours, which made it very, very nice.
Now, Larry was... Lawrence B.
Lawrence B. Edlin and
was with the administrative staff.
Yes, he was the hospital adjutant.
Adjutant. Mm-hmm. Okay, and of course an army.
Yes.
Adjutant.
Uh-huh. Then we kept our we had the patients on VE Day, which was a big celebration. Our doctors ordered, for medicinal purposes, an ounce and a half of liquor for each patient. And the staff went around with one food cart with beer, one food cart with the medicinal.
With the medicinal plus ice. Could you have any ice? Did you have
yes,
ice?
We had
ice.
Uh-huh.
And water, so it was on the rocks, wherever it was.
And all of us girls had, they also had hooked up a loudspeaker system because we knew it was coming,
yes.
And so that it could be announced over the loudspeaker system. Also, all of us girls had brought over a formal or a long dress.
I did too. I had a formal dress
for that day. So we were all dressed up, and the patients got up and lined the walks, all those that could, could because of the lack, or they didn't have their neighbor's liquor and theirs too, and watched. Well, we went over to the dance. We were having a dance that night, and wouldn't you know, the inspectors, a nurse, and another inspector, and I don't know what headquarters they were out of.
Don't tell me they came and ordered you out of your formals.
They came and read the colonel, and the colonel and the chief nurse did not go to the dance or party because
they didn't want to be able to
didn't want to be able to say that they had seen it. And so the inspectors came in and ordered us all out and back and into Class A uniforms. So you can imagine what
that was a place where a relaxation of orders should have followed, where someone was sticking too tight to the book.
And
sometimes this really got to you.
It really did.
And then there were the ones who said, "Oh, phooey."
Phooey, yeah. Well, you know, after what everybody'd been through and whatnot, and the excitement of all, difference would it have made?
And the men loved.
Oh, they just oohed and aahed, and I don't care what we could have been in, just anything other than this olive drab stuff that they'd been looking at, you know. And they just thought we were the
most beautiful. And every time they looked at you, where they were seeing another woman in that dress.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Someone they loved.
Mm-hmm. So then on, our unit was closed on D plus 1 year. And we were moved over to France. To run hospitals that had just recently come over to France and would be moved on into Japan.
That's right. The war wasn't finished.
No. And they were going to be then taken down and shipped over to Japan.
And you were older personnel,
and
so you had higher points.
So what we were going to do is go in and work those hospitals till they were closed and then just move from one to the other.
Yeah.
And so we went from down to Southampton and over to Le Havre. And there were many units. And I cannot remember the camp that we were from Le Havre. We went to a camp, and then
was it in Le Havre or near Le Havre?
We went in trucks, so I know, and we had to go through Paris.
Oh,
so it was
on the east side of Paris, beyond Paris.
And it was an area where there were several hospital units being held. And what they were going to do, was move in half a unit, half of our unit, and then move out half of the hospital that we were taking over.
Yes.
They would move out half of their unit and half of ours would
half
move
the
in.
Half the personnel we're talking
uh-huh.
about.
Yes. And then they would be trained for a few days, and then the other half
would move
in. And this was kind of a holding area for that. So anyway, we did take over a hospital in Soissons. This was a hospital full of displaced persons.
Very interesting.
And there was times in which we did not have anybody in the clinic again who could speak English, because they were all, some of them were
Poles,
Russians, Poles.
Lithuanians, Estonians, Austrians.
Mm-hmm.
I had such a mix once too.
And sometimes they were civilians, sometimes they were army.
Slave laborers, sometimes they were army.
And then that hospital was closed, and we closed that in, this was in June, and I would say latter part of August.
Of 45.
Uh-huh. And then we went up to Toul, France. I don't know if it was up or, anyway, we went to Toul, France, and did the same with that hospital.
Where were what were your patients here?
They were mostly American.
Yes.
Then I was sent home from there. I had had enough points at this point, and was sent on home. One of the things, while we were at Toul, there wasn't a whole lot in physical therapy at that time.
It wasn't wounds so much as sickness.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they sent me to, and here again, I'm getting old, my memory doesn't serve me, because it was just for 5 days, I know. Mm-hmm. We went over to, it was a large hospital complex, and there were many, many hospitals there, and we worked in a couple of large clinics. But the thing that impressed me most at that point was there were so many of us that our showers were scheduled according to a roster. If you had a shower, I only had one shower for the 5 days I was there, and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so I had to take off time to go take
a bath.
My shower.
Well, at least you had a bath.
But at least I had one. And
now, what was it that you did on this 5 days of detached?
I was working in this hospital where they did
the
have
physical therapy.
Right. But anyway, I was discharged back home in October of 45. And
you came home just about the same time I did. I came home in October too.
And then.
And what stage had your romance reached at this point?
Well, at this point, we had been, my husband and I had, of course, met before we went overseas. Yes, up in the 80, he was adjutant of the 82nd all the way through.
So he was in Spokane.
Uh-huh. And we double dated the first time we went out. I was with somebody else and he was
with somebody else. But you switched partners.
Well, within a week to 10 days we were dating. And then before we went to Toole, he transferred out to a unit that was going to go overseas or go to Japan.
Uh-huh.
And so everything was just kind of, you know, up in the air. We kept saying that we would be married. We wanted to wait till we got back to this country to be married because there was nothing that was
very
normal,
permanent, normal
or
way
anything.
Were, right.
And also, I was the youngest one in the unit. I celebrated my 20. I was only 21 when I joined it, and. So,
we're still under 25.
And so he kind of felt that I may have been using him as a substitute for my home situation or something. But of course I didn't. And so when we got back, he was down in Marseille getting ready to go to
Japan
when VE Day or VJ Day occurred. So he actually got home before I did.
That was sneaky, wasn't it?
So anyway, he stayed in the Army then until March of 46. And then we were married August 1st in Hibbing, Minnesota of 46.
1946.
And then I returned to Louisville where I started in my Army career and continued on with the Veterans Administration.
Did you go to work with Veterans? Mm-hmm. I had forgotten.
Yes.
That. Uh-huh. And how long were you?
I was only with the veterans about 6 months, and then went into a private hospital.
Private hospital. I know that you ended your career as head of the physical therapy unit. What did it? Was it director or
yes.
supervisor? I'm not
director.
Director.
Physical therapy.
Physical therapy at
Parkway Medical Center.
Parkway Medical Center. Right. Here in Louisville, and a responsible position it was. That, I think, covers a good portion of your service very, very well. And I have been thinking of the various questions that we were supposed to ask you from time to time had you not been able to flow so well with your story. And I think that you have beautifully covered almost all the subjects. What uniform you wore, what your living conditions were like.
beds. Six beds in these little cinder block huts. They were not too well constructed because when we had a snowstorm, sometimes we ended up with snow on our beds where that had been filtered through the ceiling. And we had one stove in the middle of the hut that was, we measured it one day, it was 9 inches in diameter and 11 inches high and no grate. And that we could, during the winter, we could light it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and let it burn. And we had, we were allotted so much coal, and that was it.
You had coke too, did you not?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Coke, maybe it was coke, I don't know.
It was very hard to light there, I remember.
Uh-huh. And then it would, we could keep it going until we went to sleep. And we became very adept at dressing under the covers in the morning.
So you wouldn't have to get out of bed.
Uh-huh. And our, I know we had the fire buckets in our hut. For every other hut had fire buckets. And I know some of the girls, the first ones up would say, there's ice on the fire buckets.
They began to appreciate the 19th century when that, people used to break the water in their pitchers.
That's right. But then when we were in England, in France, we lived actually in the hospital itself because they had rooms, they had certain areas where the staff lived. And then in the one up in Toul, there was little houses around that we lived in, and that was in the summertime, so we didn't have any.
No problems of cold, whatnot.
The mice were the only problems, and that was minimal. I mean, we didn't.
You were lucky. I had rats in my chateau. It was not fun, and I can remember going down to get the lids off of large food cans in the kitchen, and I would block up the holes that the rats were had gnawed behind the wallpaper in the bedroom, and jam these lid tops down so that the rats couldn't get into the bedroom, but they could get freely into the bathroom. And we'd close the door, and in the morning porcelain of the, or the enamel of the tub and the toilet and the wash basin would be covered with little footmarks. It was just lucky. Yeah, rats, I think I would not care to live with.
No. We did, in England, we did have just one large latrine that had some showers, and of course, and that was about a block from the
little huts where you
from
were living.
The huts, and we would have to
walk down there
with your flashlight at night. And
that was not too good if you had weak kidneys.
No, and during some of those cold winter nights, it wasn't too good.
So the last thing you did was take that walk down to the latrine, and the first thing in the morning.
That's right.
On those dark winter nights in England, it was not too pleasant, I'm sure. The whole situation of latrines is very seldom ever mentioned, but yours were proper toilets, and they weren't.
No, they were not the holes.
The holes that you had to struggle with on the continent.
And we had one bathtub.
Oh, they gave you a bathtub.
Uh huh.
Did they have a black line marked where the water should come to? I saw many English households with a line marked, painted on the tub on the inside, and that was the line where you were allowed to have your hot water.
No, these, I guess maybe because the hospital was built for Americans and just put in.
Could you have as much hot water as you wanted to in the hospital?
No, and your water pressure, as I say, was very, very low. I don't remember that was
a problem.
Too much of a problem. I think it was more of an understanding, you know, that you
would be fair about it.
And
Now, how about the, that covers your living conditions pretty well. Were you able to beautify your little concrete hut at all? I mean, did it have curtains? It had blackout curtains,
certainly.
It had
blackout curtains, and so that was that kind of a limit. They weren't curtains, they were boards.
Oh, they were boards. That's interesting.
Big boards that you had to clip on. And so therefore, you couldn't put too much
dressing on them. So, and you didn't have bedspreads or strictly Army?
Army, and you had inspections periodically just to make sure that
yes.
It was.
You put your locker underneath your foot locker underneath your bed?
Yeah, at the end of your bed.
At the end of your bed. Mm-hmm. And then you had upright lockers for
the floor? No, you had,
lockers.
There was just poles.
Just for coats.
Mm-hmm. To hang up your things. And then we had.
This is horizontal poles or vertical poles?
Horizontal.
Horizontal poles at the end of the hut?
Behind each of your beds.
Oh, I see.
And so your clothes were kind of hanging down above you. And one center light.
For the whole room?
For the whole room. And there was
didn't do much reading in bed, did
no,
you?
No, uh-uh. And there was just really enough room for the seven beds and a pathway kind of through. By the time you got all the foot lockers and everything in there, and if you wanted, what some of the girls did was put, if there was enough, if they were by the stove, then that gave them a little bit more
They allowed a little space.
They would put theirs up close to the head of the bed, butt them side by side.
What was the color of the inside of the, just cement color?
Just cement.
That was one thing I did have. I had a room I could decorate. I had a bedspread, which I was able to buy on the civilian market, I had a chair, an easy chair in my room. I never had a chance to sit in it very much, but I had one. The only chair in the room, but it was.
Our huts all had names. And,
oh, they did? Well, that was at least
a little. And so we would put a little sign on the outside, and our hut was a whatnot hut.
A whatnot hut.
And the how that came about, Larry was, giving out orders one day at a meeting, and he said, "Officers, nurses, Red Cross workers, and whatnot." So that
I
left
love that.
The dot. That left the dietitians and the physical therapists.
Therapist says,
and there was there were three dietitians, actually, and we picked up a third one, and so that left five. And then there were two nurses, but they were kind of outnumbered at that point. So we called it the whatnot.
I think that was a very, very appropriate title. How many of the girls married men in your unit? They were long associated, so.
Oh, we had lots of them. I married, of course, Larry the adjutant. One of the dietitians married the, mess officer. Our chief nurse married our commanding officer when they got back to the States. We had, that I can think of, three nurses that married either administrative officers or
medical
officer. Administrative officers. And about four nurses that married old corpsmen when they got back to the States. We had a Red Cross worker that married the sergeant major.
Oh, I see.
So we had really
a very large number of
and there may have been more than
ripened after the war was over. Well, that is quite a list. I think we're coming to the end of our tape very shortly,
So I think I have asked all the questions that are appropriate. One I do remember was about, did the men treat you as inferiors? Now that sounds like a women's lib question. And I never had any experience of that kind, nor did I feel that the girls themselves were feeling that they had to maintain their feminine rights of any sort. Did you get that feeling?
No, the men were very protective.
Yes, they were.
We were not, from our hospital unit, we were not allowed to go on leave or out on any sightseeing tours or anything unless one or two, because we went in groups all the time,
yes.
Unless there were one or two men
with them.
The
now, this was even in England.
Yes.
And very much so on the continent.
Yes,
that was nice. They were protected.
We were just one big family, really.
Right.
We'd been through.
You didn't
everything.
Find any that resented your presence.
Oh
there,
no.
Particularly not in
no.
a hospital. I think you were about to say highly respected.
That's right.
that is the way I always felt we were treated. That we were cherished and respected and. I know that the men moderated their language from four-letter words if we were even anywhere within sight, and I was amazed at the fact that they would never use anything except the most respectable language in front of us, as they would have done at home.
That's right.
And the only way I learned some more four-letter words was by hearing around the corner. At any rate. Now, let me ask you, we have been talking while we've changed reels, and you have told me that you recall that just before you closed down the hospital at Whitchurch in western England on the Welsh border, in Shropshire, which they call Salops too. S-A-L-O-P-S.
I never
found
heard
that out not too long ago. I found it on a map. That you received some prisoners of war, American prisoners of war who had been interned in Germany, and I think this is very necessary to put in as to what had happened.
Yes, we received many patients that had been released from the prisoner from the prisons in Germany, and you can imagine after we had given their people such excellent care, what mixed emotions we had when we received these patients that were very, very thin. Matter of fact, they were skeletons covered with skin. They were even unable to close their eyes. And they were very, very ill.
They were emaciated. They had been starved.
That's right.
And what were their symptoms beside this awful thing at night? Tell about how going into the wards at night you could see.
We'd go into the wards at night, and there would be it would be just like skeletons lying there with half open eyes because they were so weak they couldn't even close them. We found, but of course, we have to remember this too, when the Germans were losing the war, they were without food lines and whatnot, and they were going to take care of their own before they worried
yes,
with
they
the
were,
prisoners.
Were
so it was a
food
different,
supplies, right.
It was a little different maybe situation. But one of the things that happened was when our soldiers went into these camps and released prisoners and saw the condition they were in, they wanted to help them, so they gave them their candy bars and they gave them the food that they had, and of course the digestive system was such at this time it just made these poor people sicker and very nauseous, and
they threw it all up.
So there had to be an order issued that these people were not to be fed when they were released.
Who did? I've often wondered about this. Do you know
how they first treated them, because obviously by the time they got to England, they had to be fed, or they would never have made it. Mm-hmm. They had to be fed from the time they were released. I mean, what did they do? Did they have medical teams that went in?
I'm sure they must have, because that a lot of them were, we had to treat by IVs. I don't remember exactly how they, you know, came to us. And they responded fairly fast. So I'm sure when they went in, there must have been teams that went into these areas, because, especially after the first one or two, because they found that this was very kind of par for the course as far as this was concerned.
They must have had teams prepared to go into the prison camps, because I've never met anybody who did it.
No,
but they must
either.
Have had, and perhaps the medical officer, whatever unit was freeing the prison camp, was the one that first met them.
Mm-hmm.
And they must have had a different. The prisoners must have been in different condition. That's the most recent ones in better condition
than the older
than the older
one.
And perhaps you got the worst of the lot.
Well, we got it was a mixed group, because. They were sent back to us, checked out, and were flown home. They did not go back by boat. Anybody that was released from our hospital was sent back as soon as they were able to travel.
They went back,
and I can remember there were several cases where an anniversary or a birthday or something was coming up, and they wanted to get back for that so badly, and. It was stretched a little bit, you know, maybe they weren't quite ready to go, but the psychological effect was going to be greater than
the
anything.
Physical.
So we saw to it that they got back at that time.
You didn't make the girls go back and take their formals off.
No.
Put on a Class A uniform. You bent the rules for the need.
Another thing that I might, this might not be exactly the time to mention it, but I was a member of the Physical Therapy Corps. Now that no longer exists. It went into the, our uniforms were exactly like the nurses, except that we had a PT on our caduceus instead of an N. And only at the time that I was in, only women were taken in and commissioned. After the war, it was turned into the Medical Specialty Corps.
Which included a larger number of people.
And that included men also. But if you were a graduate of an approved school of physical therapy, you were commissioned in both instances. Now, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think that core is still
A viable part of the Army.
I think that's the name of it at this time. But
you were attached to the Army.
Yes, at that time, and our head, I couldn't think of her name, but our chief in Washington was Major Vogel.
Vogel?
Vogel,
V-O-G-E-L. Means bird in German, Vogel.
Is it? And and the medical specialty corps, when it went into medical specialty corps, that also included occupational therapists, and I don't know if speech therapy or not.
I see. Well, it's interesting how the organization of the Army and the Air Force too, and everything else has changed so much since the war. And of course, we say since the war, we're forgetting Korea and Vietnam. It's our war, and so it seems to be the war to us. I want to get back to those released prisoners of war. I mean, how did you treat them? You said you gave them IVs at first, which would have fed them intravenously.
And then
what was the? How did they bring them back? I mean,
we did very little, if any, physical therapy on them. As soon as they were able to travel, as soon as they were strong enough where they could be flown.
But how did they get them that strong?
Oh, but through their IVs, through your salt diets and your vitamins, and it was done very, really quite rapidly because it was just a matter of, say, maybe a month or so when we then closed down and moved on. Because so they had to be
within a month. They weren't able to travel.
Able to get back.
I've often wondered what they did with people who were very starving, because there were those terrible concentration camps, of course, which had thousands to deal with.
The types of patients, of course, that we did treat throughout the war were your gunshot injuries, your burns,
your breaks,
your fractures, your trench feet. We had a lot of that. Also, we had, of course, every type of gunshot wound imaginable, concussions, your brain injuries, the things that you saw and the things that you treated at that time, you would not see in a lifetime of civilian practice.
So you got very good training there.
Mm-hmm.
I have, and I think you lived very intensely.
Oh yes.
In the war situation, you, as you say, your experience was in the medical field was accelerated. And I think wouldn't you say that the your social experience was accelerated too? You saw all kinds of men under all kinds of various pressures, and you were able to have the kind of person-to-person experiences that were very unusual.
I think this was one of the things that, as far as my own personal life was concerned, how many people, before they were married, could have seen the person they were married under all sorts of
stress.
Having worked maybe 24 hours straight and
still maintaining his
under duress, mm-hmm. and learning to deal with seeing them deal with every type of a person imaginable
and every kind of a problem, mm-hmm. and to see how well they did it. Exactly. Of course, I also knew my husband for 9 months before we returned to the United States, and he proposed in the United States, and we were married in the United States. But I saw him in a different situation. You had special problems there. He had special problems, and he performed them well. But he wasn't under the same type of situation. Theirs was a great deal of boredom. Mm-hmm. He was an intelligence officer, and he would read the photographs, or he would look over the photographs that were taken by our photo reconnaissance planes. And his work was done very early in the morning, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then they would sleep in. And then the rest of the day, until there was another batch of photographs for them to observe, they wouldn't have anything to do. And I think this boredom, this lack of employment, was about as hard on many of the men as too much to do, because it tended to make a lot of them react in what we would consider an improper fashion if we were back home. And I was so pleased to see that Ned behaved in a very normal manner. When he went into Brussels, he would have dinner, perhaps go to a museum, and or take in a movie. There weren't any girls or wild dances or wild parties. He would return to camp in the appropriate hour when the bus came back. And his behavior was entirely that of a person who respected the country in which he was and expected to behave himself as he would in his hometown. And he obviously had come from a good family with a good background. And I can remember thinking, you know, he's really a very well-behaved man. Not like some of the others. Unfortunately, there weren't too many of them, but some of them were pretty wild.
That's right.
So it was. Well, I think that we've said everything we want to say now.
I believe so.
All right. We will turn this off. And this is the end of this interview with Penny. We've always known her as Penny, not as Sarah. Penny Edlin.